Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're going to have a chat with Adam Boileau about all of the week's security news, and then we'll dive right on into this week's sponsor interview with Chris Kennedy, Attack IQ's CISO and VP of Customer Success, which is a title, if ever I've heard one. We'll be talking about a few things, really about how continuous validation of security controls like monitoring is a good thing. Everyone uses software like Tenable to verify their patching. Why not do the same for your monitoring? We'll also get his take on all of the vendors embracing MITRE's attack matrix all of a sudden. You've heard at least one guest on this show express concern that the value of the matrix will be diluted by everyone's marketing department overusing it as a way to sell their stuff. Chris doesn't think that's going to be such a big problem. He thinks the attack matrix is the common language we've been missing in this discipline for a long time. So yeah, that's an interesting one. That's this week's sponsor interview, with big thanks to Attack IQ, who of course make attack simulation and security control validation software. But yes, it is time to get into this week's news segment now with Adam Boileau. And Adam, first up, we got a story here doing the rounds about how the NSA has apparently basically stopped doing telephone metadata collection on Americans. This is the program that was authorized in 2015 under the Freedom Act as a replacement for their kind of illegal program that Edward Snowden blew the whistle on. This was the one where they were collecting phone metadata on all Americans and just stuffing it into a database. The 2015 Freedom Act thing was a bit of a compromise, more like a metadata retention scheme. But yeah, apparently they haven't touched it in months and will probably, there's not much of a drive to reauthorize the Freedom Act as it pertains to this, and that's going to sunset real soon. It's an interesting story.
Yeah, apparently they had a bunch of issues where they were allowed to ingest some data from the telcos, at least one of the telcos, I don't say which one, was providing them with a bunch of more data that they weren't necessarily authorized to have, which, shocking, isn't it?
American telcos doing something like that, You ask them for some data and they're like, here, just have all of it.
But yeah, apparently it was just more work to RM to clean that out of the database than it was to just delete the whole lot. And they haven't really been using it since, so...
I'm seeing a lot of commentary around this saying, well, it clearly proves they never needed this. And it was, I kind of think maybe it just proves that people are using over-the-top applications to communicate these days and that a capability like this is less and less valuable.
Yeah, certainly no one phones anybody anymore, right? Everyone uses WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger or one of the, IP-based chat systems. And I'm sure Phone Collect is just not the SIGINT goldmine that it used to be.
No. So, that's an interesting one. Now, look, let's contrast that to what's happening in China. And I think it was last week or the week before we spoke about some massive surveillance database that was looking at facial recognition surveillance of Uyghur Muslims in China. And some Muppet left a whole bunch of that data exposed in an S3 bucket or something. We've seen more details on a different side of Chinese surveillance being left laying around on the internet. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so apparently a bunch of researchers were rummaging around looking at open MongoDBs on the internet, and they found a big cluster of MongoDBs that appeared to be ingesting social media from inside China and then being distributed out to the police force and various things in the provinces who would make a new database table every day to chronicle their investigations into people's private messages on a bunch of different Chinese messaging sites, kind of interesting seeing the creepy machinations of a totalitarian state, in operation on the internet.
It's all the stuff that when we were 18, we thought NSA was doing, but now China
exactly
is actually doing
right.
it,
it's such a contrast, isn't it? Because everyone's like, NSA always spying on my stuff. It's like, no. Chinese government knows how to spy on stuff. NSA is like, well, we had to have legal authorization to spy on your stuff, and now we have less authorization. So, oh, well.
Now, look, staying with China, apparently, there are spies everywhere and they're Canadian.
Yes, the two Canadian gentlemen that were picked up in China as, very conveniently after the CFO of Huawei was picked up in Canada, they've now been accused of operating some kind of spying operation. Although, to be fair, one of these guys lives on a town that borders North Korea, which, maybe that would be a good place if you were going to be spying on things to be. But apparently they've been accused of a bunch of spying-related things, right a couple of days after Canada agreed that they are going to extradite the Huawei CFO to the US.
Yeah, I mean, one of these guys is a former Canadian diplomat in Beijing who took leave from Canada's Foreign Affairs Service to work as an analyst for a non-government organization called International Crisis Group. You know, sounds like, you know, someone who you could pull off the street and charge with espionage, and it might look like it fits. But, you know, the Canadian government has said that these men are guilty of nothing more than being Canadian in China. Certainly the charges coming from Beijing look pretty vague. Let's just say that.
Yeah, we certainly haven't seen any real specifics here.
No, that's it. Now, last week we spoke about, of course, how North Korea had been targeting a bunch of people in the lead up to the Trump-Kim summit, the second one. More detail on that, courtesy of the New York Times.
Yeah, apparently McAfee researchers managed to get hold of like access to one of the North Korean C2 boxes. It doesn't exactly say how, but you know, whatever service provider was hosting this particular instance gave them access through some means, and they spent a while watching the North Koreans going about their business and hacking a whole bunch of people, you know, across a number of industries of relevance to the North Koreans. But yeah, real interesting insight, and you know, I think even McAfee are a little surprised at how much access they ended up having to this operation.
Yeah, they're getting more and more prolific, if you believe what you read. But yeah, did we steal that C2 data? No. Might have fallen off a truck, I'm guessing, is the official line on that one. Turning our attention to WikiLeaks for a moment, and subpoenas everywhere at the moment, right?
Yeah, there's Chelsea Manning has been talking about having received a subpoena to appear, before a grand jury in the US. Doesn't say about specifically what, but the case number is the one that relates to WikiLeaks. She's attempting to fight it, argue that that she shouldn't have to testify. She's, you know, certainly retained a fairly high profile lawyer that's good at getting people out of these kinds of subpoenas. So that's one. And then we've seen some stories swirling around this from some other of the old WikiLeaks crew who've either been asked to testify or have in some cases. So,
well,
yeah,
one definitely. So this other subpoena that I'm talking about here is David House. This is a guy who met Manning before she was imprisoned and then formed some sort of support network for Chelsea Manning. So, I mean, what we can say here is the subpoena activity seems to relate to the 2010 stuff, not the, you know, Russia stuff. And you know, this is kind of what I've always thought would get Assange into trouble is going to be CFAA stuff relating to the 2010 stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, David House is one of the people who actually did go and testify, and he's made some comments about what the questions they asked him, and they did all seem to relate to, you know, the conversations between WikiLeaks and Chelsea Manning and whether or not, you know, kind of WikiLeaks had encouraged or sort of, you know, facilitated that rather than just, you know, being a conduit to distribute information that had already been taken. That seemed to be the focus that he implied that the questioning was about. So, yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, well, as I've said a few times on the show, I think, you know, someone on WikiLeaks' behalf, maybe Assange, maybe not. I mean, they'll make that argument, I guess. But offering to crack a hash for Manning, that's going to get you in trouble, I suspect. Now, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, but we spoke about this weird situation with the crypto exchange Quadriga, where the founder had unfortunately died in India and no one could access his laptop to get his cold storage keys and passphrases and what have you. And that's very sad. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars gone. Well, there's been a bit of a twist to that story, which is the cold wallets that supposedly held these hundreds of millions of dollars were empty.
Yeah, apparently Ernst & Young, who were taking over the operations of the exchange, trying to get some money back, managed to get access to the laptop, presumably either guessed the passphrase or obtained it through, you know, maybe it was stored somewhere. They got access, they went to look at the cold wallets, and yes, sure enough, a few months ago, they got cleaned out. It appears the guy had made like a bunch of other accounts. I think they said 14 other user accounts, quote, created outside the normal process, unquote, that had been used to exchange trade on the exchange. And now there's no money there anymore. And he's, well, I was going to say, he's allegedly dead. Like, there is, someone did go and dig up the death certificate from.
Yeah, but already, I mean, you know what the crypto community is like. I mean, they're all, I imagine at this point, a lot of them are like, show us the body, you know, like it's
pretty much, yeah.
But I mean, you know, it could be nothing. It could be something. I mean, maybe this guy is in Belize having the time of his life. You don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe he, you know, did a little too much boasting down the pub about how much money he had in his cold wallets and someone helped themselves. Like, we just, yeah, we don't know. I mean, like, the thing we do know is there ain't no money in that crypto exchange anymore. And if you have money in a crypto exchange, you don't have any money anymore. So
can't keep it yourself because someone will steal it from you. Can't leave it with an exchange because someone will steal it from them. Seems to be basically the thing. Rob Joyce, who we will be hearing from this week, spoke at an event in Hanover, Maryland last week. And, you know, he was talking more about this sort of defend forward strategy, which NSA has been talking up, which, I mean, it really does sound like they're gearing up for a cyber knife fight, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a bit of, you know, cyber boots on the cyber ground, saber rattling going on.
Cyber rattling.
Cyber sabers, yes, exactly. They are being rattled. We've seen discussions of this that were, you know, kind of, yes, we should be more, you know, more forthright, more aggressive, more, you know, out there, you know, defending forward, as they say in their terminology. But yeah, I think last week we talked a little bit about some of that. But it does appear they have been doing some of this.
Well, yeah, I mean, we spoke about how they took the Internet Research Agency in Russia offline. I mean, that was a leak apparently from Cyber Command. Cyber Command, you know, kicked them off the internet during last year's US midterms. We got some additional detail here. IRA says that NSA in fact released the deadly
internet weapon.
The deadly internet weapon, which is better known as the RMRF Shark. The RMRF Shark may have had a good time munching through the IRA.
Yeah, apparently they managed to get, deliver some kind of Trojan mail into someone who worked there, get onto the LAN. There was some other reporting from Russia that they got in through a mobile phone, like an Apple iOS. I think they said an iPhone 7 Plus or something, which was then subsequently plugged into a computer on the LAN. They pivoted across from the phone into the desktop, you know, classic NSA techniques here, and then went rummaging around the internal network and, as you suggested, found a bunch of file servers. One of them, they appeared to at least have RMRF'd a little bit, which, you know, rather put a spanner in the works. They also apparently went off into some cloud-hosted stuff. The IRA had Amazon hosted infrastructure. They went up into the cloud, RM'd a few things up there as well. A bit of fun chomping through data for the RMRF Shark today.
Malware research has been having a great old time tracking down Cobalt Strike C2s.
Yeah, there was a trick that I think Foxit were using to fingerprint Cobalt Strike command and control servers on the internet. The embedded Java web server they used put a trailing space on the end of the first line of the HTTP response. And so by going around the internet, you know, making HTTP requests to every web server you can find, you can fingerprint this particular web server, which really isn't used by much other than Cobalt Strike. That was a really good trick to spot people who were using, of course, Cobalt Strike a tool for managing your hacking has really kind of picked up in popularity amongst black hats recently. This was a good trick to keep track of them. Obviously, legitimate users of Cobalt Strike probably have received an update that's now patched out this particular fingerprinting technique, but, you know, underground groups probably less likely to be legitimately licensed. Mudge might not be patching them quite so quickly.
Now, last week we spoke about Motherboard's story about a couple of employees of Hacking Team going off to work for, going off to create some new tech that does blockchain surveillance. It was acquired by Coinbase. Then people started rioting, saying, how dare you, you know, hire these people who trample human rights. And I sort of think, you know, on one level, fair enough. On another level, hey, it's great that they're not doing that sort of stuff anymore and maybe they've turned a new leaf. Well, apparently Coinbase has bowed to, you know, social media and, you know, other media pressure and is, quote, transitioning out these former Hacking Team people. But I'm guessing they're going to get to keep their money. So for them, it's basically more free vacations.
Yeah, I guess more disposable income to spend on whatever their next venture is going to be. But it does make you wonder what Coinbase have ended up buying then. As these are the three Hacking Team dudes in question were, you know, the people who built the thing that they bought. So one wonders how much value they're getting for their money now. But maybe it's easier for Coinbase to just write it off, you know, kind of sigh and then move on with life.
Now, there's been some interesting developments in the bug bounty space. And, I've kind of covered this off to a degree in the sponsor interviews with Bug Crowd. So disclosure, Bug Crowd is a sponsor. But what's interesting here is HackerOne seems to be following a strategy that Bug Crowd announced late last year, which is, hey, we're a pen test firm now. They seem to be really trying to stand up. You know, they all say the bug bounty marketplace is worth about $150 million or something, whereas pen testing is a $1 billion industry. So now, lo and behold, Bug Crowd and HackerOne are offering like, it's like Uber, but for pen tests, right? So you can register on their platform and get deployed to do tests. I just think this is an interesting kind of pivot from you know, the two biggest companies in the game. What's your take on this, Adam?
Well, I think it's – I can certainly see their argument. I mean, there's a lot of things that the bug bounty world has improved in the security industry, I think. I mean, the concept of bug bounties in general is really useful. And it makes sense for them to move from, you know, really only being able to do bug bounties on the outside with a relatively low level of trust in the people you're getting to do the bug bounties, to a more structured approach where you can give the testers more, you know, more access to internal systems, access to pre-release stuff in a more controlled manner with a more controlled scope, which is much more like regular pen testing. And yeah, if you've been using bug bounty programs for that, then, you know, I could absolutely see you getting good value out of that. And to be fair, there are a lot of really rubbish pen test firms out there. And I don't disagree with either HackerOne or Bug Crowd saying that, you know, they may be able to improve the quality of the work. I mean, as a pen tester myself, you know, I run a pen test firm here in New Zealand. I like to think a pretty good one. I don't think we're that worried about.
I wouldn't expect that, but I would have thought what this is going to be most useful for is you're about to ship some, you know, web app, which is essentially just, you know, a simple website with some dynamic, you know, aspect to it, and you need to get it tested quickly to tick a few boxes. This is going to be a great way to do that, I think. I do see that. I don't see this being a replacement for, like, you know, high-value, high-skill pen testing. But I do think it's interesting that both Bug Crowd and HackerOne are going down this road. I think to a degree it's an acknowledgement that the bug bounty thing hasn't scaled to the extent that people wanted it to, certainly the people who are running those businesses. So this almost feels like a type of weird semi-pivot to me.
Yeah, I think there's two aspects, right? There's the amount of people participating and the extent to which you can. I mean, and opening up it to more traditional pen testing kind of gives you a broader set of people who can do the work. I mean, not everybody is geared up for the kind of, you know, competitive and quite focused in a way nature of bug bounty hunting. Like, it's a particular subset.
But if you look at where the money goes, it goes to like a handful of people, right? And they'll all say, we got 15,000, 20,000, 25,000 hackers registered on our platform. But if you look at the number of active people, it's not actually that much. And of them, there's like a core group at the top who seem to make all the money, right?
Yeah.
So it just feels to me like these platforms are pivoting into a way to more efficiently connect buyers of pen test services to people who offer pen test services, which is a pretty different business from the one they started out in.
Yeah, I mean, that, I guess, was the second point that I was going to make, is that, you know, being able to have a bunch more structure about how you engage lets you target the work as a, you know, a buyer of pen test services, lets you target that more where you know that you need it. And so, yeah, I think you'll get a bigger pool of people. Perhaps you'll certainly get a bigger pool of work available for people. So, yeah, I think it's a good fit for HackerOne and Bug Crowd. But, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it does point to some sort of, you know, deficiencies in the extent to which the, you know, existing bug bounty approach has really scaled.
It is, of course, RSA week this week. You know, there's been big announcements from all sorts of companies, everyone releasing their software, including NSA. And we got two bits of software we're going to talk about this week. The first is a bit of software which NSA says is designed to help mitigate supply chain risk.
Yeah, this is a really interesting program where NSA have been working with Trusted Computing Group and Intel to come up with a mechanism to kind of do attributable supply chain validation, so that when you get a motherboard, for example, in the TPM chip on the motherboard are a bunch of certificates and other ways that you can attest to the state of all of the various components on the board. So I imagine, I haven't seen the specifics of how it works, but I imagine there's going to be a way where you can say, here is the firmware that we loaded on this, you know, the USB controller or the, you know, the offboard Ethernet controller or something at the point of manufacture, and you can go through and validate that during the boot. And they have a piece of software called the Host Integrity at Runtime and Startup thing that NSA has written that allows you to kind of interrogate this database. And I think, you know, obviously supply chain is super hard. NSA have, you know, probably bigger concerns than average about supply chain security. So, I mean, of all the people who would have the means and the motivation to get this right, it seems like a pretty natural fit. So, yeah, I'm certainly interested to see this, because this is a very real problem for anyone running high-value environments.
Now, the other big release from NSA is Ghidra, which everyone is, super excited about. This is, of course, going to be a free open source reverse engineering package. I mean, the buzz around this has been ridiculous, hasn't it?
Yeah, everyone's very excited. And I do, I fear that the hype can't possibly be met by the reality of, let's face it, it's a similar sort of thing to IDA or some of the other, binary reverse engineering tools. Apparently NSA have been using this for a while themselves, so I imagine it's pretty polished. In the end, it's a pretty specialist tool and it's not going to magically hack the Gibsons for you.
Well, it is government software as well. Let's not forget. And when was the last time you saw government software and you're like, wow, can't wait to get my hands on some of this. I spoke to Rob Joyce about this. And funnily enough, the thing that he said to me is like the most useful feature that people are going to really like is you can undo. Right? So you can actually step back and you can't do that in some of the other platforms. He says this isn't designed to compete with other software. For them, it's really about something that they can open source, get people using it. It's good because more people will be reverse engineering stuff. It sort of makes things more accessible from that point of view. It's great because they can start getting the tool used in curriculums and also so that they can, hire people who already have expertise in their in-house tool. But I actually spoke to Rob and asked him a couple of questions, and here's what he had to say about it.
Ghidra is the product of years of engineering here at NSA. What's really great about the tool is that it builds in three features essential to how we do our workflow. It's scalable, customizable, and collaborative, which for our mission is really important. So we released Ghidra as an open source product to make the software reverse engineering process more efficient, which will help the cybersecurity world. We find it valuable looking at malware, especially streamlining the analysis of new variants of code related to malware that you've previously analyzed. So the ability to look closer at things you already knew and find the variants and changes. We also expect the tool will enhance cybersecurity education from Capture the Flag competitions to school curriculums and cybersecurity training. And something directly beneficial to us is by releasing this out into the wild, we'll get people who can walk in our door familiar with a tool that they could potentially use in their daily work. A strength is a wide variety of the microprocessors supported. Major processors include variants of the x86, ARM, PowerPC, 68000, and a host of others, right? And a key feature is that we have a processor-independent modeling language that lets us grow and add new microprocessors as we change or need new variants. I know it doesn't sound like a big key feature, but a big deal for us is that it has undo, so that if you've gone forward in the reversing process, you realize you made a mistake, you can actually go back and undo the things you've done and take a different path. The best feature, though, is Ghidra's free. If you happen to be here at the 2019 RSA conference, stop by the NSA booth and we've got experts who work on it.
I just love that. NSA coming on Risky Business to say, stop by our booth.
What a crazy, crazy world we live in.
Now, of course, everyone's out there going, oh, the Ghidra is an NSA backdoor. But Hacker Fantastic did find something quite funny after installing it.
Oh dear, oh dear. So it is written in Java, so negative points for that. Turns out that it runs up the Java debug Y protocol port on a high port, which of course, if you can connect to it, is instant code exec on the box that's running it. So
so it's not an NSA backdoor so much as a everybody backdoor.
Yes, if you've got network reachability to it, then yeah, that's kind of a backdoor for everyone. So yeah, yay.
So sorry, Rob, you're getting a sad trombone this week. Sorry, mate. Sorry about that. But congratulations on the launch. Now, of course, full disclosure here, full disclaimer, Chronicle are a sponsor of this podcast. I think I worked it out. They pay about like 7% of the bills over a year. They launched their big thing, right? Which is basically like they're trying to do for SIEM and security event information collection. They're kind of trying to build Gmail for that. I recorded and published a Soapbox episode on this and that went out yesterday. But I've had a few days to sort of think about what it is that they've done here. And I'm actually finding myself thinking increasingly that this is going to be a winner. And I just wanted to get your take on it.
Yeah, so this is their backstory product, which basically lets you ingest a whole bunch of logs from your various things and then, kind of use Google's expertise at, Alphabet Chronicle's expertise at rummaging through data and you know, giving you a nice, easy interface to leverage that data that you've got over time, which, you know, that's a problem a lot of people have. I mean, I don't know how many of you have been into a SOC and seen how miserable SOC life is, and anything that makes working with your data and pivoting on things that you're interested in more effective and faster and more powerful, SOC teams, blue teams are absolutely going to love.
See, that's not the bit that I'm getting all excited about. I mean, what I think is once they've got, say, 2,000 customers who are submitting good information from them, and keep in mind, too, that they've said NetFlow is on the roadmap. I had Greg Shipley on this show a few months back talking about how there is no virus total for network data, right? And we need that corpus so that we can start doing things like applying machine learning. And, you know, the reason he came onto the show is they'd written a no data or no payload flag for TCP dumps so that people could actually start collecting this type of metadata. Now, if you've got that NetFlow, as well as information coming from Carbon Black and CrowdStrike, and you're going down to level of like, you know, you've got a one-year record of every single registry change that's happened in your enterprise over a one-year period, you're combining that with network data, you're doing it in aggregate, and then you've got a whole bunch of really smart people with access to core Google infrastructure who can then go and start doing analytics on that data. I think the potential here, you know, when I recorded it, I'm like, oh, okay, it's cloud Splunk, right? And now that I've sat with it for a few more days, I actually kind of think this could be, if they pull it off, it could actually be quite transformative.
Yeah, I mean, having the data and then being able to draw the right conclusions from it, right? You know, that's the real hard part. And Google has a history of kind of being able to do that. So, yeah, I mean, I think if they pull it off, it really does work as well as, you know, I imagine it probably does. I mean, Google's, you know, they're not prone to doing things completely half-assed in the security space. And there's plenty of other things that they cock up. But, you know, security is one thing they do seem to kind of think through. So yeah, I mean
Chronicle is distinct from Google. It is owned by the same parent company. So we should sort of make that clear. But as I say, I just think that one's going to be interesting. And sorry, listeners, I mean, we're talking a bit about industry stuff because, hey, it's RSA week. Now, speaking of RSA week, Adi Shamir, who is the S in RSA, could not get a visa to travel to the United States to speak at the conference. I mean, this is just insane.
Yeah, that's not ideal. Kind of high profile, and yeah, it does make, I'm sure, a few Americans feel a little bit embarrassed. But yeah, that's the problem with having conferences around the world. Is a lot of people got to travel, and yeah, that's as a conference organizer with my hat on for that, I understand the feels.
Yeah, yeah. Martin Groten has pointed out that, look, I'll just read his tweet. He says, Shamir is, of course, right in his criticism of strict US visa procedures, but to add a sobering perspective, we have had speakers who couldn't get a visa when we had our conference in the US, Canada, and the EU. For most of the world, visas for the West are really hard. Some great news. W3C has finished off the WebAuthn standard. It is official.
Yeah, no, this is good news. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are relying already on, you know, kind of earlier work in this field, either the, you know, kind of early releases of WebAuthn or, you know, kind of the original, you know, FIDO specifications for doing more effective than password authentication in browsers and other things. But yeah, having this codified into a final WC3 standard, you know, it's just good for the ecosystem.
Cisco's come through with some comedy bugs.
Yeah, you're going to have to get the sad trombone button out again because this one's pretty bad. So, there's a bug in a bunch of Cisco kind of small business routers, the RV series ones. And I do have to say, at least it's not a default credential, although there are default credentials that if you read the guy who found this particular bug's blog post, like he sneakily drops a couple of default credentials in a screenshot and doesn't mention them. But anyway, the bugs in question are strict copy buffer overflow in the like password field of the web interface. Like, just what are you doing, Cisco? What are you doing?
Cisco gonna Cisco is what we say there. That reminds me, though, just what you mentioned about the screenshot. It reminds me of when Mark Dowd dropped like pretty serious Ode in his book. Do you remember that?
Yeah, he dropped some I forget what the bug was, and in Teosa, yeah, sneaky guy. Actually, Silvio dropped like FreeBSD kernel bugs in the handbook of one of the B-sides Canberras. Didn't tell anyone. That was pretty funny too.
That's great. More bad stuff on GitHub. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, there was a set of GitHub accounts kind of going around promoting a bunch, you know, a bunch of accounts promoting one particular account to try and raise it up in the search results that had, you know, Trojan installs of a bunch of common pieces of software. So the idea, I guess, is if you Google for a particular, you know, software installer, you see a GitHub link, you think, oh, well, GitHub must be legit. Download it, install it, get yourself owned. Yeah, this was doing it for something like 300 different apps of various degrees of commonality.
Project Zero has dropped some Privesque on Apple for macOS.
Yeah, this is obviously some people at Google have been looking around for other instances or other, you know, related bugs to the copy and write bug that we saw in the Linux kernel last year sometime. And they found a bug they're calling – actually, we don't do bug names, do we? No names.
They found a bug
which, yeah, involves using copy and write on removable disks to kind of overwrite stuff that's been cached or something like that. So, yeah, local Privesque on a Mac, pretty sneaky. And, yeah, this kind of, you know, makes sense that they would go looking for other sorts of bugs. It's the sort of thing that Project Zero do really well.
If you're a Cold Fusion user, I mean, I don't know what advice I have for you, really. I mean,
sad trombone.
You are where you are. I mean, what can we say? But apparently Adobe has released an out-of-band fix for Cold Fusion, which is, you know, but that's not what you want to hear, is it? You know, like, especially if you've got some of that to look after.
Yeah, like, how can there still be more bugs? And this is like file upload, you know, unrestricted file upload, upload a JSP or whatever.
There's lots of Cold Fusion out there. I mean, just ask the Asset Note guys, right? And they love Cold Fusion because there's always...
Yeah, well, everyone loves Cold Fusion. It's the best.
Well, Adam, mate, that is actually it for this week's news. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. As you know, Risky Business is a sponsored podcast, and each week we get our sponsor on to have a chat. And this week's show is brought to you by Attack IQ. They make attack simulation software that you can use to basically test your security posture. You can generate weird behavior on hosts, generate funny network traffic, that sort of thing. And then you can actually measure the effectiveness of your controls against the generated activity. Pretty simple idea, really. But, you know, there's a bit in the execution, right? Which is why Attack IQ exists. Now, in some ways, this is a type of verification that's similar in principle to vulnerability scanning. You know you've got patching programs in place, but you still do your scanning anyway to see what you might have missed. You know, you need verification is a big part of patching. You need to verify. Well, using something like Attack IQ, you know, is a way to verify controls other than patching. You can see if your monitoring is working, you can see if your EDR is deployed right, that sort of thing. And like vuln scanning, Attack IQ believes this type of activity should be continuous, not point in time. Chris Kennedy of Attack IQ joined me to talk through that idea, but I started off by asking him if a weakness in Attack IQ's business model is that it relies on people actually having decent controls to verify in the first place, as in, many organizations wouldn't consider themselves ready to use this type of tech. And here's what Chris said in response to that.
You know, it's very interesting. I was just talking to a potential client yesterday, and that conversation came up. I am not in a position. I am not organized enough right now. I don't have the right people. I'm still putting the locks on the doors to have something like that. And I actually, I don't believe that. And the reason why I joined Attack IQ is because I believe in the power of the continuous assessment strategy as a way to drive your risk management program. And the statement of, like, what do I do when my dashboard of assessment turns all red? Well, now you can have an intelligent discussion about if it's all red, what's the reddest of the red? And that allows you to then decide how to actually better deploy your controls. Mm. Folks make natural assumptions that my segmentation strategy is the most important thing I need to do. I was just reading and co-authoring a blog about, you know, the boundary of your traditional enterprise is, you know, the forward boundary is also the last boundary. Where did the boundary go because of hybrid infrastructures and different web applications and enterprises moving away from those traditional models?
It is interesting, right? Because you can use the sort of continuous nature of stuff like Attack IQ to sort of gauge your progress over time and see where you need to pay the most attention now. But as a point in time exercise, it's interesting as well. Just as you were talking there, I was reminded of an interview I did years ago with Gary Hayslip, who was then the CISO for the city of San Diego.
Yeah.
And that was actually a sponsored interview that Tenable organized, because he was, you know, he was using Nessus to basically get an idea on where his worst, you know, patching problems were. But he actually name dropped Attack IQ, and this is like years ago before Attack IQ was a sponsor, but he actually name dropped Attack IQ because, you know, and I know it doesn't gel with the continuous monitoring topic that we're talking about today, but he was using it as a point in time exercise to sort of gauge, when he first came on the job, sort of gauge where he needed to put in the most work, like immediately, right?
When you drop into an organization, especially that has a disorganized security program, you have to make a bunch of decisions, and the board probably expects you to do it pretty quick. And so that visibility matters most. And so tools like Attack IQ, like your Tenables and your Qualys's, they provide a tremendous amount of information.
But they tell you when your patching sucks. They don't tell you when your monitoring sucks. And that's, you know, they're both kind of important.
You got to go get under the hood of the SOC and see what their capabilities are. You know, it's funny you mentioned that too. Like, this is a really important use case of continuous security validation that, frankly, I had an epiphany as I was investigating this product, but when I was a buyer, and how many people believe their SOC actually works and the dependence of the ecosystem that informs it? Like, all the sensors are reporting, the logging is all showing up in the Splunk. In the Splunk instance, the correlation logic has actually been vetted and works. The operator behind it is actually focused on the right index. Like, all of those things, and the dependency of the security pipeline is what we call it, is actually working well for that operator. It's like a very powerful capability of continuous security validation. It's one of our primary use cases of SEL.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, that makes sense as well. So I guess, you know, you've argued yourself into a good position here, which is, you know, buy Attack IQ to see how much of a disaster you are, and then keep using it to validate that you're actually doing better.
Yeah.
You're having your cake and eating it too there, Chris. That's pretty well done, right? Deft interviewing.
Well, you know, and there's even in that space, when you think about that construct, we have other customers that are considering it in the same way for underwriting cyber insurance policies. Like, I want to have an assessment of your environment. This is a quick and easy way to understand how red the dashboard would be before I up your insurance policy.
Are you engaging much with the insurance companies?
We're starting to. It's there's structural processes for that, and it's kind of like changing the regulatory market. Like, I'm also a champion for this, and I don't believe that the way regulators actually audit organizations are actually helping security, and I want to see them do and require more like activity. And so you got to
what are your primary criticisms there? I'm curious.
Oh, sure, certainly. First and foremost, it's a managed engagement, and that how you tell the story of what you're doing is highly influential and not as data driven as it should be. It's temporal. Point in time for the assessment in terms of when it happens. It's not continuous, and it's driven out of a set of regulatory requirements that are often checkboxy, and those things just don't actually ask the right questions in many ways. And so I think, you know, if I was to say, if I had, you know, all the money in the world to hire more people for Attack IQ, I'd want to hire some lobbyists to go lobby for regulatory change, because that's how you actually change the security climate within the country and within the world. I don't know that GDPR is helping right now. It's certainly creating a lot of pressure on businesses, but the ambiguity introduced in the law and how people are interpreting that versus actually having a demonstrable evidentiary-based strategy for how you protect data.
Sure. But I think sometimes, you know, we forget in the InfoSec industry that GDPR isn't an InfoSec law. It's a privacy regulation that has some, you know, some InfoSec impacts and requirements, but I take your point nonetheless. Now, look, Attack IQ has been using, you know, has been drawing inspiration from the MITRE ATT&CK framework for, you know, a long time, right? But it's become very, very hip lately, and I suspect that, you know, as this podcast runs, which is going to be during RSA, we're going to be hearing every single vendor at RSA hyping up, you know, how MITRE ATT&CK framework, like MITRE ATT&CK matrix compliant they are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering what Attack IQ's feelings about that are, because on one hand, it's nice seeing, you know, a foundational bit of, you know, thinking that you rely on becoming kind of an industry standard. But do you worry that it's going to sort of dilute the perceived value of you know, products that adhere to the matrix, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm not worried about the dilution. I actually think a common language that everyone can understand is going to be very helpful for the industry. I think our product's very unique, and continuous security validation is still very emergent. And so us being kind of leading edge on that is both helpful for our company as other companies are adopting and understanding that. And it allows us a simpler way to click into whatever the other strategy is on the other side that's clicking into to MITRE ATT&CK as well. Organizations that are going through SOC transformations and aligning all of their monitoring logic to MITRE ATT&CK so they know whenever the alarm goes, what stage in the kill chain they're in. Now they can build a validation of that and have that connected directly into it, for example.
So you're saying this is a positive trend?
I think it is. Is like a common language that everyone can share and a framework where we understand where in the kill chain we are and when we're invoking whatever the defensive strategy is or the validation of the defensive strategy. Makes it easier. It's a common lexicon.
Now, look, we are recording this on the Thursday evening before RSA. I'm going to make some predictions, and you know, by the time people hear this, we'll know if I was right. I'm predicting we're going to hear a lot about MITRE ATT&CK, as I just mentioned, but I'm also predicting we're going to hear just ridiculous amounts of blah 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 about zero trust. Right? Everyone wants to be a zero trust vendor since Duo Security got bought, you know, for a gajillion dollars by Cisco. You know, because every year there's a theme, every year there's some buzzwords. Are you getting that vibe already yourself, Chris?
Yeah, totally. My former employer was also really interested in that. Many of our customers are really interested in it as well. But it's interesting. I mean, it's a really hard thing to do, and it's transformationally, as an organization that's well established and has kind of the old enterprise habits to break, it's a long road to get there. And it radically changes the security paradigm in many ways. It also amplifies the need for visibility and validation because of the nature of it changing the security paradigm. You know, traffic's encrypted, you can't see it. You don't have the traditional security controls that you've always relied upon in zero trust environments. And so what does that mean? You have to know your security works because you're assuming parts of it aren't.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. And I'm going to be really curious to see who tries to rebrand themselves as like a zero trust company, you know, an enabler of zero trust without completely destroying the meaning of what zero trust is. But I guess we do not have long to wait to find out, to see how people will mangle those meanings. But Chris Kennedy, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about ATT&CK IQ and the world of attack simulation. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it has been. Thanks for the time.
That was Chris Kennedy there from ATT&CK IQ, and you can find them at attackiq.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.